commentary track presents Radio Movies, classic radio shows based on classic films, with your host, Frank Thompson.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to episode 19 of Radio Movies. I'm Frank Thompson, your friendly host. I'm the friendliest host you know. I always say hello, and I'm really glad to meet you. Wherever I may go, I'm kind to every living creature, because creature rhymes with meetcha. Get it? It's not my fault. Blame Paramount. We have a good one for you tonight. An adaptation of a really atmospheric and pretty creepy movie, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes. This radio adaptation for Screen Director Playhouse, which aired on February 27th, 1949, has two stars of the film, Edward G. Robinson and William Demarest. William Demarest playing an uncharacteristically serious role. He plays a cop and plays him pretty straight. The film was directed by John Farrow. If anybody has ever listened to me talk about anything, you'll know how much I admire John Farrow as a filmmaker and how intriguing I find him as a human. Apparently, he was a terrible human. But I've said it before, and I'll say it again, I considered him to be the most interesting man who ever worked in Hollywood. Many may find that hyperbolic, but I sticks by it. In the 40s, if you wanted a scary movie, Universal and RKO were really the places to go. Universal had all their great monsters. Do I have to list them? Frankenstein, Monster, Dracula, the Wolfman, on and on. They had the classic bunch, and they put them out in scary movies, and they put them out in funny movies like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. But you had plenty of good monster stuff going on at Universal. At RKO, you had the great Val Lewton with his unsurpassed list of great horror films, subtle, intelligent, top-notch in every way. I love most of those films. I have a particular fondness for The Seventh Victim, which I think is one of the most morbid movies I've ever seen. And The Body Snatcher is great, and I Walked with a Zombie. If you've never seen the Val Lewton films, please put this podcast on pause and go watch all of them. I'll be here when you get back. But over at Paramount, there weren't that many scary films, but the ones that came out were unusually intelligent. And as we played a few weeks ago, the adaptation of The Uninvited, this one, The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, also takes the supernatural fairly seriously. I always had a real distaste for movies that pretended to be supernatural and then in the last reel turned out to be just somebody fooling with people. It works okay in a comedy like The Ghost Breakers, but it really annoys me when it's supposed to be a scary movie. Let's say Mark of the Vampire, for instance. Ooh, I hate that movie. But Night Has a Thousand Eyes does not cop out that way. It starts out with an intriguing premise, which is about Edward G. Robinson playing a two-bit fake psychic who, to his chagrin, finds out that he has actual psychic powers and the visions of the future that he's receiving are not visions that he likes one bit. And it's a really intriguing film, not nearly the classic that I think it ought to be. So I hope that you will seek it out somewhere. Joan Caulfield was cast as the female lead, but she was pulled from the film to co-star with Alan Ladd in The Long Gray Line over at Fox. But that film, once she got over there, was shelved for several years. It didn't come out till 1955, in which time both of them had been replaced by Tyrone Power and Maureen O'Hara. And, of course, as you know, it was directed by John Ford. So once you're out of a film like this, you don't get back in. So Joan Caulfield was out of luck. And as so often happened in those days, it seems to have happened about every other film, the lead female role was taken over by Gail Russell. Now, Virginia Bruce was in this film, too. I have a particular weakness for Virginia Bruce in the early 30s. What a beautiful woman and a very talented actress. And she had a pretty weird, eventful life. You'll have to look that up because it's kind of a detour to talk about that here. But she had really bad luck in the guys that she married. I'm not sure that her current husband in 1948 had kept her out of pictures, but she hadn't made a picture in 3 or 4 years when she was cast in The Night Has a Thousand Eyes, and so it's good to see her back. And, of course, John Lund is in the film, acting all serious, and all that is well and good. An intriguing thing I found in one of the trade magazines of the time, and it's always frustrating when you can find just a little bit of something and then you can't find anything more about it. And I hope that as time goes on, I will find more, and I'll fill you in later if I do. But it was reported that Paramount was developing a new kind of starry sky because one of the predictions is that a character will die under a starry sky, and they wanted to do it in a different way, and apparently they did. But what did they do and how did they do it? I couldn't tell you because the article doesn't say any more than that. And I kept looking around and looking in other magazines of the time and newspapers, and there's not another word about it. Now, there's bound to be plenty about it somewhere, and I'm sure that some listener is saying, that fool, that utter fool, he doesn't know the facts. And in this case, I don't know the facts. Sorry about it. I do know that in August 1948, when the film was about to come out, Paramount, I love these publicity things that they did, Paramount invited 125 scientists, psychiatrists, doctors, psychologists, and, just to fill out the room, lawyers, to preview the film. And then they all went over to the Waldorf Astoria and discussed it over dinner. Well, that must have seemed like a good deal to all those psychiatrists and psychologists and lawyers. Whether any of them thought that it was a credible look at psychic powers, I can't tell you. But my guess is they didn't. Although you never know. There were smart people that believed in that kind of stuff over the years, and it happens. But an even smarter guy, because when the movie was opening in Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to be specific, the capital city, they found that Murphy's Store, which apparently was also a restaurant in Harrisburg, was hosting a pie contest. So the manager of the nearby Colonial Theater thought this was a swell idea. So he hung a banner that said, Murphy's has 1,000 pies, Colonial has 1,000 eyes. Now, by George, that's when getting people into theaters was fun. I don't do anything like that anymore. I'm sad about it, too. This is a good adaptation. As I always say when it's Screen Directors Guild, it's short, so it bleeds out a lot of the nuance that you see in the film. But let not your hearts be troubled. This is a really entertaining one, and Edward G. Robinson is, as always, just terrific. And it's great to hear William Demarest under any circumstances. And I hope that it will inspire you not only to seek out the film, but also the original novel by Cornell Woolrich, who knew his way around a suspense novel. So enjoy The Night Has 1,000 Eyes, and I'll see you on the other side.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater presents...
Screen Directors Guild Assignment. Production Night Has 1,000 Eyes. Director John Farrell. Star Edward G. Robinson.
The NBC Theater presents the Screen Directors Guild production of A Chronicle of Fear. Paramount's Night Has 1,000 Eyes, with its original team of screen director John Farrell, screen star Edward G. Robinson, and William Demarest. Although technical and artistic skills are the everyday instruments of the motion picture director, the very heart of his craft is fashioned from another sort of knowledge, the knowledge of the world in which he lives, and that can be gained only by living a life rich in experience. Such is the background of tonight's guest on the NBC Theater. A native Australian, he has been a seaman, soldier of fortune, adventurer at large, and has made an enduring mark as a scholarly writer of fiction and nonfiction. Here, then, is the director of many famous Paramount films, such as Wake Island, 2 Years Before the Mast, The Big Clock, the soon-to-be-released Alias Nick Beale, and tonight's story, Night Has a Thousand Eyes. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Farrell.
Night Has a Thousand Eyes is a story of the supernatural, but it is not a flight of fancy. Counterparts of the strange phenomena in tonight's story have been the subject of recent scientific study by some of our universities. Thus, through the medium of film, and now through the radio, we attempt to reveal a bizarre and a rather terrifying aspect of the strange, strange world in which we live. Now, for the first time on the air, here is Night Has a Thousand Eyes, starring Edward G. Robinson as John Triton, with William Demarest as Lieutenant Sean.
In the drawing room of a fine suburban home, a young man named Carson reads a strange manuscript while the company listens gravely and silently.
My dear Carson, as you read this manuscript, I will be dead. No one is to blame. My death was as certain as all the other strange events I foresaw. Some of you who have seen me die will doubt this story
and dismiss it as a series of contrived events and coincidences. But you, Carson, and some of the others will know that there are things on Earth still hidden from us, still secret and unfathomable. I suppose most men can look back and see the exact point where destiny touched them. My destiny came upon me on the night of August 3rd, 1929. I was billed as Triton, the mental wizard. Like most mind-reading acts, it was a phony, but a first-class phony. Jenny, my lovely fiancée, had collected all the questions from the audience, and my good friend Whitney Cortland was ready for his part at the piano. Now, ladies and gentlemen, from where I stand, I shall endeavor to read the questions which you have written and which are now unopened, mind you, in that glass bowl. Now, if I may have a little quiet music, Mr. Cortland. Let me see. I sense a name. Lady's name. Brian. No. Byers. That's it, Byers. Clara Byers. Miss Byers asked a question. She wishes to know. She. Something's wrong. There are disruptive impulses coming from the audience. A woman in a white dress, a little boy. Madam, you there in the third row. Your little boy is in great danger. You must go home at once. At once! Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue where we left off. If I may have some quiet music, Mr. Cortland. The incident disturbed me. But then I forgot about it entirely until late that night when the telephone rang in my room. It was the woman calling to tell me that she had come home to find the boy's room in flames. She had arrived just in time to save the child's life. And I was worried, deeply worried, although not yet frightened. There were other incidents, one of them brought on by Courtney's usual concern about our economic situation.
Well, kids, it's the same old story. Broke again. We could stand a little ready cash. Matter of fact, I'm going to put our last 10 spot on ready cash in the fifth at Green Meadows.
Ready cash? No, not ready cash. He'll fall and have to be destroyed. Peer Gynt. Peer Gynt by two lengths.
Ready cash fell and had to be destroyed. Peer Gynt won by two lengths. It occurred to me that we might make fortunes this way.
I didn't want to. It scared me. I began having a crazy feeling that by telling them, I was making the things come true. I began to wonder, would anything have happened if I'd kept quiet? And then one dismal, rainy day, I had my chance to find out. I was coming out of the theater. A little boy recognized me and asked me for an autograph. And then he turned to skip away. Wait, son! I'd had a vision of a car skidding on the slick pavement. A wild cry. And then I thought, no, perhaps if I keep it to myself, it won't happen. Nothing, son. Just run along now. Run along. He went. A moment later... After the boy's death, I knew I could foresee these events, but I was powerless to prevent their coming true.
Look, Johnny, I just met a big oil man down in the lobby who wants us to come in on this Comanche Hills oil field.
Well, so what?
Well, do you suppose you could get a hunch on a sporting proposition like that? Might make us a lot of money.
Oh, no, it's no good, Court. We're washed up on hunches.
Why, Johnny?
Well, because I'm scared, Jenny, plain scared.
I haven't had a very good feeling about it myself, Johnny.
Well, all right. We'd better get down to the theater then and earn it the hard way. Curtain in 20 minutes.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, if you will all please concentrate on the sealed questions you have addressed to me, please. A little quiet music, Mr. Cortland. I'm concentrating on a particular envelope. A young lady's handwriting. She, the young lady. The lady, I looked at Jenny. Stared at Jenny, so beautiful, so fragile and desirable and so much to me. I saw her and something else.
Johnny.
Bring down the curtain.
Johnny, what's the matter?
Bring down the curtain, I tell you. Bring down the curtain!
Are you sure you feel better now, Johnny?
Oh, sure, Jenny. I just felt a little dizzy out there.
You sure had us worried there for a while.
Oh, Court.
Yeah?
Had a... sort of a minor hunch about that Comanche Hills oil proposition. Be one of the richest oil pools in the country. Make us all rich.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, Johnny. Now let's go out and eat.
No, you and Jenny go ahead. I'll join you later. Maybe it was the wrong decision. But I went away. What I'd seen that night on the stage had been Jenny's death. If I stayed, we'd be married and there'd be a child. The child would live, but Jenny wouldn't. I had to go away to save Jenny's life and save my own sanity. I knew Cortland would take care of Jenny and Comanche Hills Oil would take care of both of them. Yes, but I knew I had to get away from people, especially the people I loved. I went away. It didn't work. A year later, I heard that Jenny had married Cortland. She died when her daughter Jean was born. I read about it in Variety. For 20 years, I lived almost a hermit's life and had no more visions. This gift or the curse seemed to wither it from this use. And then after 20 years, on the night of Jean's debut, I stood outside in the crowd and I watched her go inside the fine hotel, holding tight to Court's arm. Jenny's daughter was lovely, and I was proud. I watched them disappear inside, and after 20 years of peace, it happened. For a moment,
I saw the image of wreckage. The smoking wreckage of an airplane. And then it was gone. What did it mean this time?
But nothing happened. And I forgot about it completely for 3 months. Until one day in my shop, I turned on a small radio I just repaired.
Now the 1155 news brought by your Comanche Oil reporter. New York. Flying his converted army bomber, Whitney Cortland, multimillionaire president of Comanche Oil, took off from LaGuardia Airport early today in an attempt to smash the east-west transcontinental record. He and his pilot, former army flyer Richard Sims...
No! I was Warren Jean. Miss Cortland, I'm sorry to force my way in here, but I have an extremely important message for your father.
I'm sorry, but my father isn't here now.
Now, see here, old man. I'm Miss Cortland's fiancé. Miss Cortland...
No, you've got to reach your father when he lands in Wichita to refuel.
But why?
You must halt the flight.
Halt the flight?
That's absurd.
Why should father give up his flight?
But if he doesn't, this plane will crash.
How do you know that?
Oh, Miss Cortland, please. You're wasting priceless time.
All right, I'll call. But I'll ask you a lot of questions afterwards. I want to talk to Wichita, Kansas Airport. I haven't the number.
You make a practice of predicting plane crashes?
Oh, no.
I'll wait, thank you.
Maybe just the planes of very rich men.
Oh, please.
Perhaps you're betting that he doesn't beat the record.
Hello. Hello, this is Whitney Cortland's daughter. When my father lands, have him call me immediately, will you? What? Oh, no. Oh, no!
Radio had it a few minutes later. In an hour, the extras were on the street. The Comanche Angel had crashed in Kansas. Both men were dead.
You've been very kind helping me over these past few days, Mr. Triton. I'm so grateful.
Your father was my best friend.
But if you'd only warned us sooner, if you'd only known sooner.
I don't think it would have made any difference.
Mr. Triton, what's wrong?
You have a new maid.
Why, yes, why?
You have an emerald bracelet.
Yes.
Get rid of the maid before the bracelet. Before...
What? Please, tell me.
Jean, it doesn't matter now.
Why doesn't it matter? You mean, not to me. You mean, I won't need the bracelet. You mean, I'm going to die too? Tell me!
Yes.
When?
Soon?
When?
Before the end of the week. At night. Under the stars. Jean.
NBC Theater is presenting the Screen Directors Guild production of Night Has a Thousand Eyes, starring Edward G. Robinson with William Demarest and introducing the director of the film, John Farrow.
Remember, Carson, you went to the police. They told you, yes, there had been a John Triton mental wizard who pretended to be able to predict things back in the 20s. He sent a certain detective, Lieutenant Sean, to investigate me where I was staying in Jean's house.
My first interview with Sean in my little room under the eaves. Far from reassure the good lieutenant, for even as I answered his bitter questions, the veil lifted again. And I saw. I saw.
Hey, Triton, come out of it. Hey.
I see a flower.
Ah, drop it, Triton. Cut.
A flower, crushed and broken. I hear a sudden wind shaking the windows. I hear a voice saying, there's no danger now. And I see her.
Who?
Jean. Lying under the stars. And beside her, the paws and talons of a lion.
A lion?
Under the stars.
Did you find out what time this happens to Miss Cortland?
Tonight, as the clock strikes 11. Lieutenant Sean was all for arresting me at once. The rest of you were tolerantly skeptical, which saved me for a while. Downstairs with Jean and you, Carson, were two gentlemen, a Mr. Gilman.
Mr. Gilman, president of Mid-Tide Oil.
Good evening, Mr. Triton.
And a Mr. Myers, attorney for Cortland's estate.
How do you do, Mr. Triton?
Together, we sat down for the next 2 hours. Our lives were geared to the relentless machinery of the grandfather's clock that ticked away near the curtained archway.
Frankly, I think this is ridiculous. Sitting around like this when we should be looking for a packet of missing options.
I'm sure I'll find them, Mr. Myers.
They'll be worthless in 36 hours.
Gina, are you sure you can't remember where your father put those options?
Please, Mr. Gilman. I'm much too upset.
Well, the mid-tide merger can't go through without them.
I suggest Jean be permitted to forget about big business while we all concentrate
on the clock, Mr. Carson.
Shut up, Triton.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
One down.
And one more hour to go.
And so far nothing has materialized in your weird chain of events. A crushed flower indeed, a lion, a sudden wind.
Anyone interested in the 10 o'clock news? Here. Personally, I'm interested in the 11 o'clock
which
news.
Which was upset in a collision tonight at Wilshire and Sepulveda. The lion escaped. When a trailer
lion.
Rammed the...
Turn that off.
Lion?
Lock the doors. Lock the windows. Put out some light.
I'll lock up. I'll go through the whole house.
Thanks, Gilman.
Well, there's the lion. We haven't heard wind, or seen a crushed flower, or heard anyone say...
Don't say it!
Sorry.
Hey, those carnations in that vase. Get them out.
Carnations?
Get them out. I don't believe any of this, but I'm taking no chances.
I'll give
let me take
it.
Careful now. Stand back. Don't anybody move. Not a one crushed.
That was a close one.
Mr. Myers, there's something sticking out under your foot.
Something, Lord.
A carnation. Crushed and broken.
That does it, Triton.
No, not quite. Nothing final can happen until 11 o'clock.
And it ain't going to happen because you're around. I'm taking you downtown until after 11.
All right, Lieutenant, but it won't do any good. I'll be back at 11.
Stand still, Triton. Relax.
Yes, but I tell you, Sean, if you let me return to Jean's house, there's a chance I can use this power of mine to save her.
You put on a good show, Triton. Only I ain't buying.
Now listen. You've a man in the cell here. His name is Amos Block. I see him in his cell now, a suicide.
You don't say. Well, there's one I can check on. Hello. Quinn? Sean. How's Block doing? Uh-huh. Thanks. In his cell playing solitaire.
Well, nevertheless, I see him in it.
Now I'm going to leave you with the boys here and go back to Miss Cortland's. Be good, huh?
Minutes too, Jean.
Yes.
Yeah, everything is under control. It's a very copacetic.
Ah! Oh, dear.
Close that French window. Close it.
I'll close it, Lieutenant.
I thought Gilman took care of that.
Where is Gilman, by the way?
There. That does it all right.
Sudden wind.
Yeah. I'll get it. Yeah? Oh, yeah, Quinn? No. Amos Block hung himself in his cell, but he can't do that. That's suicide. Hey, look, I want Triton here before it strikes 11. I don't care how, but get him here. What time is it?
10:47.
Oh, Lord, you made the night too long.
One more minute to go, darling.
45 seconds.
Oh, Mr. Myers.
Well, folks, you can forget the lion. They just killed it over at Veteran Hospital.
Oh, thank goodness.
This is it. 11 o'clock.
Elliot.
Yeah?
Back to back with me. Miss Cortland, get between us. Don't anybody move. I'll shoot the man who does. That's it, folks.
It's all over. Nothing's happened.
Oh, Elliot. Elliot, darling.
It's all history now, dear. Forget it.
Elliot.
Hmm?
I'm going outside.
I'll go with you.
No. I want to get used to standing out under the stars again. Alone. And not being afraid. Thank you, dear. Thank you so much. All of you.
I'll say this for Triton. He sure called his shots except that voice saying, there's no danger now.
You just said it.
Yeah, but it's too late now to mean anything. Ain't it?
Sean.
Come in, Professor, come in.
Where is she? Where's Miss Cortland?
Outside.
You let her go outside?
It's after 11.
No, it's not.
Look at that clock.
That clock is wrong.
It was right.
Well, then it's been tampered with. I've got to go to her.
Stop, Triton. Haul her out, shoot.
It's too late for that after him. He mustn't get near Jean.
Eight. 9. 10. 11. That's right. 11 o'clock,
Miss Cortland.
Oh, Mr. Gilman.
Your troubles are over now. There's no danger now.
11 o'clock. And a voice saying, there's no danger. He must have met you.
Oh, no, you don't.
No, please.
Help me. Gilman. Let go of her. Let go of her, you fool.
There he is, Sean. Right. Get him.
Plugged him. But good.
Jean, are you all right?
Oh, Elliot.
It's all right, Jean. You're safe now. Triton's dead.
Triton? Dead? But it was Gilman who tried to kill me.
Gilman. He didn't want those options found. But I didn't think he'd resort to murder.
Oh, poor Mr. Gilman. He died to save me.
But are you all right?
My throat hurts. Elliot. Look, Mr. Triton, he's resting against the foot of that marble lion.
Marble lion, of course. ¶¶
And that, Carson, ends this dark diary. I foresaw everything, even my own death. And tonight at headquarters, I finished
this diary. I left it in my pocket for you to find. Only time and the expanding wisdom of mankind will confirm the story in years to come. For there are reaches of the mind still undreamed of, and there are many mysteries of time and space and spirit to be shown to us. The stars look down. The night has 1,000 eyes to search the soul of man and see if he is equal to his fathomless tomorrows, where there are yet more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in our philosophy.
In a moment, we'll return with our stars. Next week, the NBC Theater brings you another first in radio, a full-hour production of director Billy Wilder's great Paramount film comedy, A Foreign Affair. And starring in this hour-long drama will be Rosalind Russell, Marlena Dietrich, and John Lund. And now, here again are tonight's stars, Edward G. Robinson and William Demarest, and screen director John Farrell.
John, it's been great fun for Bill and me, slipping back into character for our parts Night Has 1,000 Eyes.
Well, I just hope Bill here doesn't start having one of his visions again.
What, you mean cool, solid Bill Demarest is in tune with the supernatural?
He thought he was.
Now, wait a minute. I know what you're talking about, and I really did have a vision.
Yeah?
I was standing talking to Johnny on the set, and suddenly I knew one of the camera booms was swinging around behind us.
What happened?
He yelled, "Johnny, fall on your face."
Well, did you get hurt?
My nose was almost broken.
By the camera boom?
No, by falling on my face. There wasn't a camera within 50 yards.
Well, I had a vision.
Well, we don't have to be visionaries, John, to know that your direction inspired Bill and myself and everyone else connected with the picture. You did a great job.
Check, Eddie. That goes for me, too.
Thanks very much. But suddenly I seem to be getting a vision myself.
What do you see?
I see us being cut off the air if we don't say goodnight. Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks.
And good night to you, Edward G. Robinson, William Demarest, and John Farrell. Night Has 1,000 Eyes was adapted by Milton Geiger from an original story by Cornell Walrick. Music was by Henry Russell. Production was supervised by Howard Wiley. Associate producer Bill Carr. Your announcer has been Frank Barton. Night Has 1,000 Eyes was presented through the courtesy of Paramount Pictures, currently releasing My One True Love, starring Phyllis Calvert, Melvin Douglas, and Wanda Hendricks. Edward G. Robinson is currently making the 20th Century Fox production, The House of Strangers. William Demarest may be seen in Paramount's Technicolor production, Whispering Smith. Listen again next week for the NBC Theater's full-hour presentation of...
Screen Directors Guild Assignment, production of Foreign Affair, director Billy Wilder, stars Rosalind Russell, Marlena Dietrich, John Lund.
The Screen Directors Guild program came to you from Hollywood. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
I hope you enjoyed that adaptation of The Night Has 1,000 Eyes. I realize in the intro I didn't really say much about Cornell Woolrich, and I should have said a lot more. One of the great suspense writers. I think he's way up there with Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler and those guys. Wrote many, many terrific novels and short stories. I remember one of my favorite short stories is called Papa Benjamin, about a guy who runs afoul of a voodoo priest. That is awesome. He wrote a short story that Alfred Hitchcock used to make Rear Window. And Francois Truffaut filmed his novel The Bride Wore Black. And another story called Waltz in the Darkness that Truffaut filmed as Mississippi Mermaid. And they're just terrific things. So I know the show's over, and I don't want to keep you here overnight. But I just thought I should say more about Woolrich. He's great. Just about anything you read, you're going to be happy you did. Just that I'm happy to have a wonderful wife who's also my announcer on this show and on the commentary track, Claire McCullough. Thank you to her. Thanks to James Hutchins for designing my websites, commentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. And thanks to my pal Mike Bolt for writing the theme music to the show. Long may you wave, Mike. And I hope that you will continue to support this show and the Commentary Track and tell your friends and get other people to come listen to all of these shows and go to the website and go through the Amazon link and buy lots of expensive things so that I'll wet my beak a little bit. Won't cost you an extra penny. And Amazon doesn't lose an extra penny. Well, they do. They have to pay me out a little bit. But it's a tiny fraction. But if many, many thousands of people did it, I'd be rich. Rich, I tells you. So I urge you to do that. Got another good one coming up in our October series of spooky radio shows based on spooky movies next week. And I hope that you'll listen. And in the meantime, try to get hold of The Night Has a Thousand Eyes and watch it. You'll like it.